Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 170, Raising the Banner of Victory on the Mountain Peak.
When I was first in Dharamsala in the 60s, there was a English doctor in the Western clinic that some foundation had put up there for the refugees for some condition that they worked better with. He always recommended people with jaundice, with arthritis, you know, certain diseases. He would send them to the Tibetan clinic, his patients. He says, we don't have good medicine for this. We don't have good medicine for that. And then they would send people to him. Which is, that's the thing in India. In India, there's four legal, actually now five legal medical traditions. And they kind of interact, but they're not, some of them are more like, you know, territorial about their thing. But they kind of interact, and they know different things are good for different things. And Tibetan medicine was officially legalized in the last Congress before the BJP came in. BJP doesn't mind. And actually, the Ayurveda industry does mind, because Tibetan herbal thing are preferred by people who know about it because they consider them more organic, they're less industrialized. You know, Ayurveda has become highly machine-oriented and industrialized in India. But they're still very good, a lot of Ayurvedic things, but they're very competitive, in other words. They have 55 clinics around India and Nepal, and they're very successful. And the Dalai Lama makes them keep their price very, very low and also give it free to really poor people, which they complain about. The managers of the Tibetan medical thing, oh, he forces us, we could get more money. They can't, he won't let them. But they're still very prosperous. They still thrive because they are helpful. I eat their medicine all the time. When I run out of it, I begin to get a little like whatever. Medicine Buddha can heal all health issues and provide longevity and et cetera. But it isn't like a particular version for a particular one. I'm gonna come now to a little bit the medicine teaching. There are sort of 404 categories of diseases in the Buddhist medicine, this is all elaborated. But the medicine Buddha, the way he teaches, is different beings emerge from his own chakras, from his own mind, and they ask him questions, and then he answers them. That's how he gives the teaching. And there are different, different parts of his person become separate beings in the medical sutra. It's very marvelous, actually. But anyway, they have a setting of 404 main different issues, as you're calling it, health issues. And of those 404, 101 are what they call sort of incidental or casual. And they can just be healed by a little change of lifestyle or diet or something. They're not really, they don't need medical treatment. They just need advice. And then 101 are caused by negative spirits, some kind of curse or demon or bad spirit, goblin. They have a huge list of different kinds. And they tend to congregate in hospitals, actually, by the way, and they where people are kind of weakened, you know, because there's something wrong, something else, and they like infect you. And then they make it hard for regular therapies to help you, but normally would, you know. So there's 101 like that. So there are 101 where you referrals to an exorcist or a psychic lama or something like that, or in India, a psychic siddha, adept, you know, guru. And then there's 101 that are called karmic. And that's like our one where they say it's genetic, you know. You're done for, there's nothing we can do, it's your genes. But they don't ever blame genes, but they say it's your karma, you know. And then they refer you to a spiritual teacher to help you, you know, use whatever lifetime you have left. or in whatever condition, to develop good karma by meditating this and that, learning this and that. And then finally, there's 101 to be treated by medicine. And then of medicines, there are 18 different things to do with them. And then there, you know, after diagnosis and so forth, and I'll talk about that. But the 18 different things are begin with, like, you know, teas, infusions, you know, teas, infusions, and then some kind of powders, and then you get finally to, then you get to pills, and then you get to, and then all kind of things like massage, hot compresses, mineral bath, herbal baths, and things like that. Lum, they have steam baths, all kinds of things like that. They have a lot of that sort of external therapy, what they call, which involve also cupping. They have cupping. They have kind of acupuncture. They have bloodletting, actually, either leeches or wet cupping, what they call, something like that. And then it goes on, and then at the very final end is, and of course, diet and lifestyle are always done. And also, lifestyle includes ethical issues about the way you're living, because that will affect your health. If your conscience feels bad because you're living, doing a certain thing, that will harm your health. And then finally, surgery is the 18th possible thing that can be done, rather than an early thing. And they had very elaborate surgery, but they had fallen into disuse in Tibet. But in Buddha's time, there was a famous doctor called Jivaka, who was the king, the doctor of a king who was his royal doctor of one of Buddha's great supporters, King Bimbisara. And also he treated Buddha for minor things and others. And he did brain surgery and so forth. Even in those days, they did sometimes if necessary. So in other words, they deal with all different kind of conditions. But it isn't like you have a particular form of medicine Buddha to do that. Medicine Buddha can do all of those things, if you will. I did study Tibet medicine myself. And I had to pass an exam. I got as far as passing this exam, and I did pass it. And then I did some clinical work under the Dalai Lama's physician of the time, and the one who refounded what's called the Menzikang, or the Tibetan Astro Medical Institute in Dharamsala, which had been the one in Lhasa. And the exam, there are three roots like this, three trees like this, which have, each, some of them have two trunks, some of them have three. This is the first one, but this is a good one to talk about and show you. And you have to memorize, there's, I think, 260 some leaves. You see the leaves? And then there's so and so many trunks, and then branches and leaves. And the three roots, you know, three main roots there are. And you have to know every leaf and what it all is and what it all means. You have to memorize that and be able to draw it out by memorizing what's called the root tantra. And here the word tantra means something like technology. So it's the medical textbook. It's called the four tantras that were codified. They're based on the Indian one called the Ashtanga Hridaya, Amrita Garbha or something. Amrita Garbha. And that's an Indian text. But then it's more elaborated because the Tibetans gathered knowledge from China. The Tibetan emperor in the 9th century held a 30-year conference, medical conference, where he gathered Greek physicians from the Persian ones from the Persian court, Mongolian ones from the north, Tibetan ones, of course, healers and physicians, Chinese ones, and Indian, and Nepali, and Bengali. And Indian means, you know, Bengali, Kashmiri, Nepali, Bihari. You know, India was different nations, you know. And they all gathered there, and they collected things within the framework of the Buddhist medical thing, which has to do with the medicine Buddha. And so they collected this knowledge. For example, the urinalysis is not, they don't have it in Chinese medicine, they don't have it in Ayurvedic medicine, looking at some unclean thing, the Brahmins wouldn't want to do that. But the Galenic tradition had it. And it's a wonderful, amazing, it said the urine is the magic mirror within which the skilled physician can see the workings of the body of the patient perfectly. But it isn't any urine. It's the second half of the first pee-pee in the morning. If you didn't have sex, get drunk, or drink too much tea or coffee on the night before. This will give you the really accurate reflection. And I can't tell you how amusing it is. I used to take the Dalai's physician on grand rounds in different American hospitals. And when the resident and the young doctors would see the Tibetan doctor stirring the urine, the patient in a white cup, you know, sniffing it, touching it to his tongue to make sure they didn't have diabetic or hypoglycemic issues, tasting it, and looking at it and saying, too bad I can't keep it for a day or two, because then they watch how the albumin lies, what height it takes in the dish, what colors change, etc. It's like it really elaborate. It's amazing, truly amazing. What it reflects, you know. It reflects what the liver and the kidney and all this kind of thing is doing. It's amazing. And that comes from the Galenic tradition, actually. And many Chinese physicians and Ayurvedic physicians who were during my days of traveling with those doctors and translating for them, they would show up and ask for an appointment, and then they would ask about it because they wanted to add that, you know. And then also the pulse. The Chinese have, but the Ayurveda doesn't really have that. And because not wanting to touch people by the Brahmins. But the Indian Buddhist monk certainly did. And then you take your, you know, you have 12 different meters in the corners of your six fingers, of these six fingers. They're 12 meters, you know, this and this, like this. And then you put it on the radial artery, like this here, at different depths, sort of more superficial, the first finger, then a little deeper, the second, and a little deeper, the third one, but without smothering the pulse for the first one. And then you're getting six things registering. You train yourself to reach psychically, mentally, into the body of the patient. And, for example, with this finger, you get the heart and the upper intestine. On the upper corner is the heart, on the lower corner is the upper intestine. In the second finger, you get the liver and the gallbladder. In the third, you get the, the bladder and the sexual equipment, I think, something like that, and a male. In the female, the heart is on the right wrist pulse, and the male, the heart is on the left wrist pulse. So, and then you, and the female, on the male, you have the lung and the lower intestine, and then the kidneys and so forth. The spleen and the kidneys, the one kidney, the right kidney. Here you have, that's right, this one is the liver and the left kidney. No, it isn't. No, this one is kidney. I forgot exactly. But anyway, you train to do that. And I had experiences like with those doctors that I couldn't believe, translating for them. Back in the 60s when it was really unknown and people would just come there. And one lady, for example, came to the doctor and she was having stomach problems and she was like this and that. So he's like taking her pulse. He'd never seen her from Adam, didn't know who she was. And he's taking the pulse and he says, oh, you've been living in a very dry, deserty place for a couple of years, right? Yes, she'd been in Rajasthan. And then all these things, they're telling her all this stuff. And then they have this thing, they say, raise the banner of victory on the mountain peak. And that's when you get the, you sort of click, you figure out what's going on in the body of the patient. And then this particular doctor, he would get all gleeful and excited when he did, then he would be frustrated. He would ask like, well, you did this, you know, or that, and they would be not giving the answer he expected, you know, and then he would go back and try again. One time in one hospital was amazing, in the Worcester Hospital, actually, John Kabat-Zinn's hospital, one lady who had this sort of mysterious thing, the resident said, we'd like to see what you think, because we can't really be sure, we don't know, blah, blah, blah. And so he takes their pulse, looks at the urine, and that was one of those I had tasted it. And it wasn't the exact right time of urine, but it was something okay. And he said to her, he said, oh, okay. He said about, after doing both pulses for a long time, he said, a couple of years ago, you had a thing where in the morning and in the evening, you would have like dizzy spells. And you would have to stop what you were doing and sort of take a break. And then it would pass. And then a few months ago, they stopped. Or 6 months ago or so, that stopped. Maybe a year ago, that stopped. But now you're having whatever this phenomenon is, you know, which they were saying was some kind of heart issue or something. She said, no, I never had that. 2 years ago, no way, no. She's like that. And then he didn't like that. He was like, And then he was asking him some other questions. He was talking to the doctors, and then talking, and he was going back to looking at this and that. And then sort of a little bit down going to the foot of the bed, the conversation was going on, and suddenly she jumped up. She sat up. She had been like this. She said, wait a minute, he's right. I had forgotten. Coming back from work or driving to work, sometimes I'd have to pull over. I would get so dizzy for no reason. But then it did stop, so I forgot. And then she totally realized he had this rapport, and she became like this. And, you know, focused on this funny-looking guy with his shaved head and his robes, and he had a little bird-like face. Ishi Danden, his name. And then the resident got jealous. So he's then giving her advice about this then diet and blah, blah, blah. And then the resident got mad. I think he felt somehow outstaged or something in front of the younger, you know, intern or whatever, you know, young doctors who were on his beat there. There was maybe six or eight of them. And he suddenly said, okay, that's enough of this nonsense. We know what it is. She has a congenital heart defect. She's scheduled for the OR day after tomorrow. I just wanted to see what you were saying. And he broke this rapport that they had, and then she collapsed back in the bed like that. And the doctor was so mad. And then he says to me, he didn't speak English, he says to me, he says, ask him like what congenital means. And guy said, oh, and then I translated the question, and then I said, it means birth defect, right? He said, yes, right, birth defect. Oh, said the doctor. And this lady is 62 years old, and this just happened 3 or 4 years ago. That's the kind of congenital defect I'd like to have, he said. So in other words, he knew that guy was faking. He was just acting authoritative, you know. He wanted to reassert himself. And then he started arguing with him. The patient was there, and I said, oh, Dale, we can't do that. Because I had just seen a film about one of those Filipino surgeons in Chicago who did a demonstration of removing tumors from someone's colon or something. And then they had him arrested. They asked for a demonstration. It was in a surgical theater. I saw a film. And they were looking down these different doctors. And then he did it, and they couldn't find any chicken livers or any weird, like, you know, scam. And he was pulling stuff out of their body, and it went like this, and there was no wound. And they couldn't see, you know, they had checked him, you know, frisked him. And they were so angry that he did it, they had him arrested for practicing without a license, although they asked him to do it. So I'd just seen that, so I said, oh, no, get out, don't argue, this is their territory, they can do it. So then we went out, he was so fed up. And then when the other resident came out, the head resident, he said to him, he says, you do operating on that woman and she's likely going to have a stroke. You're going to really harm her, and they're really ridiculous to insist on this. What she has is a kind of phlegmatic condition where the fluids in her system are too viscous, and she needs a certain dietary and herbal thing to loosen the flow. And because she produced what these dizzy things are, that little bubbles, you know, like with strong surface tension. You know, I was trying to translate all this in his own Tibetan language, like form and press on certain parts in her brain. And those will subside when she calms down and when the fluidity gets more fluid. And her system is warmed, you know. She was a smoker and stuff like that. And she's eating probably too much ice cream and too much cool things, you know. And so he said, and therefore, if you give her the shock of surgery and heart surgery, he said, what you're seeing in the heart that you think is a defect may be a bubble there. There may be some kind of bubble pressing some membranes apart. But it will flow out itself if you do what I'm telling you. And if you do surgery, it'll harm you. She'll harm her because the bubbles will form like that, and she'll probably have a stroke, he said. And so I know it is not your business, you're a patient, but I just have to warn you. And then I asked the guy who invited us, who wasn't that resident, another person to that, and he would never tell me what the outcome of that patient was. So I assume she did have it. They did an operation, they had a stroke. I assume. But because he would never tell me. He would say, no, she was all right, he released her. Oh, no, they did an operation, it was successful. He wouldn't say. the one who had arranged the thing. And then the doctor wouldn't go ever again on ground rounds. That was the last time. He said, I'm not going back to those places. They are not hospitals. They are butcher shops, he said. He didn't like it. He was upset about it.
This episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast is a part of the ongoing class series, Force for Good, based on the teachings of His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Daniel Goleman's Force for Good book. To watch free videos from this ongoing annual series, please visit Tibet House US on YouTube or visit Tibet House US to learn about the next time this class series will be offered in New York City. Join in person or online. Special thanks to this week's sponsor, Menla Retreat and Dewa Spa, located in Phoenicia, New York, just 2 hours north of New York City. To learn about upcoming programs with Robert Thurman and friends, and their create your own getaway packages, please visit menla.us. And now back to Bob in the second half of this week's podcast.
Okay, back to the tree. Oops. Where's the tree? Oh, it hopped back there. There. Now, this first branch, this first trunk, is the healthy trunk. And there are 15 leaves here, you see. And these 15 leaves are five kinds of energy, or what they call wind. But wind doesn't mean a breeze like that. Wind just means motion. So it's actually just energy. There's no mass involved. The mass is from earth element. In other words, the elements are sort of archetypes rather than substances. But they're physical. So there's five kinds of energy. You know, there's what's called the life central energy. There's the metabolic energy. There's the upward rising energy. There's the evacuative energy. And there's the motor, the all-pervading motor energy of the nervous system and the muscles. Those are the five types. And there's five minor types that have to do with different senses, you know, hearing, sight, etc., smell, taste, touch. And but this represents the five major, which are really key. This is qi, you know, in acupuncture, what they talk about, qi, prana, in Ayurveda. This is key to the Asian medicines. And this is the key that will eventually heal the materialist medicine of our culture, of our present culture, and introduce it back to a more balanced and humane thing, because this is the bridge between physical and mental, between body and mind, is the energy, you know, the wind, movement, you know. It can be electrical, it can be respiratory, it can be digestive, it can be circulatory, but it's the motion, moving energy. Then there's five types of bile, which are like the acidic heat part of the system, and then five types of phlegm, which is earth and water, so it's substance and cohesiveness. And the bile is really fire, acidic, you know. And there are five types. And therefore, you know, people often translate these 15 different things, or sometimes the three humors as humors, but they're not really humors because the wind is not a humor. Greek medicine didn't have the wind. They did have pneuma in Greek, but it wasn't considered a medical thing because that's where our materialist thing comes from, in a way. You know, the psyche was sort of separated. And but here, the wind is a physical sort of side of the mind, you could say, because Buddhism is not dogmatic. Buddhist science is not dogmatic. It truly is paparian, if you know the philosophy of science a little bit, meaning that all theories are hypothetical. They're accounting for what evidence and data you have up to then in the best possible way, most elegant, But they are awaiting falsification by different data that then improve and be refined. And supposedly, therefore, there are no dogmatic laws of nature. That's the true empirical science is that in the West. And Buddhist science was that from the beginning. Because of Buddha's, you all know, I think you've all been in my classes, so I don't need to go, I think mostly, right? So you know how Buddhahood is defined. You know the definition of Buddhahood. Does everybody know that? No? Some of you? Oh. So, well, see, Buddha, when you become a Buddha, you will have a weird experience about your sense of identity because you will think you're everybody. And you actually will be. In other words, what's called your reality body. You identify yourself as everything. That's what a Buddha is. A being that has expanded that sense of identification. You know, like when you're in love with somebody or you have a baby or, you know, someone you're really close to, then you can kind of empathetically feel you're them, maybe in some special moments, right? Or even more largely, sort of subliminally, families will stick together, you know, even buddies in platoons in war or teammates, you know, taking the knee, fighting Donald Trump, whatever. And, you know, they identify with their someone else, so they feel they are more people. And our culture is a little bit harder, the way the language is and the way we are sort of told we're individualistic, when actually we're a horrible bunch of conformists, actually, but never mind. We're told we're individualistic. And whereas certain cultures, they have different language and grammar, and it's more easy, like Japanese are famous about togetherness, you know. But I won't tell that story. Let's digress on that story. But the other cultures, especially cultures that have had a long exposure to Buddhism, the we becomes much easier to reach from than the I, you know. But it doesn't mean that the I is not very, very strong. It's just that the I realizes itself by developing the ability to identify as the we, actually. It strengthens the I to be able to do that, actually, rather than death dissolves it or it becomes weird. So anyway, when you're a Buddha, this expansion that the human being is capable of expanding your sense of identity to incorporate other beings, the Buddha being does that infinitely to an inconceivable degree. So therefore, they feel they are everyone. And then it's more complicated than that. They feel they're everyone in two ways. In one way, they identify with everybody as themselves also being completely in nirvana. Everyone totally all right. Totally everything is made of bliss. That's the experience of a Buddha. That's how it's through that bliss, which melts your narrowness of identity, melts you into expanding it. And that vast kind of what they call great bliss or universal bliss is where they then see everyone as perfect, totally fine. But since they feel they are everyone, they can't miss that most of the people, a lot of the people, feel they don't feel like they're nirvana. They're like, I'm not blissful. I don't have enough bliss. I'm miserable. I have a headache. Oh, I'm getting old. Oh, my teeth ache. Oh, and people don't like me. Oh, they didn't do this. Oh, I don't have enough money. Oh, I don't. They're going to take away my pension. Oh, whatever, you know. They are just sitting there filled with fear, dissatisfaction, irritation, and confusion. But luckily, the nature of Buddhahood, the good news of Buddhahood is that that feeling that we have, you know, based on through the three poisons of misknowledge, you know, active ignorance, that is, misknowledge, greed, lust, desire, hate, anger, those three poisons, ignorance or misknowledge, you know, lust and hate, those three poisons, you know, make us like this. But so Buddha doesn't miss that. That's how we are gripped by these addictions, emotional and notional addictions. Afflictions, people say, but that's not a good translation, actually. They're addictions. Because they seem good, like when someone gets angry when they're feeling oppressed, they think they feel very powerful, so it feels better. But actually, then they make a lot of damage, both internally and externally, so it's worse. But that's like an addiction, you know. It makes you feel better, but it's actually harming you. And same with greed, you know, same with delusion. Anyway, so Buddha perceives everybody as himself on those two ways. So, but luckily the bliss way is stronger than the confusion and the suffering way. That's the good news of the Buddha. So therefore, Buddha is sort of present in everyone as their deeper nature that they are not themselves aware of. But Buddha is, and therefore Buddha is surrounding everyone with maximum assistance to shift from this sense of separate self, isolated, separate, alienated self, to identifying with everyone, them heading in the direction of expanding their sense of identity and expanding their sense of life. And the whole Buddhist ethical system is based on that. For example, not kill. That's the reason you don't kill people, evolutionarily speaking, from a Buddhist point of view. Not only does it bother them to kill them, although when you kill them, that doesn't put an end to them. Then they'll get reborn and they'll be really mad at you next time they find you, by the way, in whatever form they catch up with you. But they won't know why, but they will really dislike you that's on sight because you killed them previously. But the point is you don't kill them because by killing them, you're pretending that you're intensifying your sense of alienation from them by taking their body away from them, stealing from them, taking their property away from them. And then the sexual misconduct one, at the time when beings, human beings at least, mammals and human beings among them, sort of do melt and identify with the beloved, in, you know, that in the sexual time, then use that as a way of abuse or domination or something bad, and to intensify alienation is really stupid, really bad. So those are, for example, those are called the three physical paths of skillful and unskillful evolutionary action, which is what karma should be translated as, right? So that's all directed toward the fact that the goal is, the evolutionary goal is to become a Buddha, where you are total bliss, you're everybody's total bliss, not just your own self's total bliss, but including yourself. You're total bliss and total compassion, aware of those who do not feel bliss, and maximum optimal, not omnipotence, but omnicompetence in helping each one try to unravel the knot of their confusion that makes them feel that they are not bliss. Because everyone is bliss. Your two cells on your fingertip, they wouldn't even like each other if they weren't happy. And then in cancer, it's just when you get miserable with yourself. And then some weird thing happens, and then we don't like that cell, and then it doesn't like you. And so, oh, it's going to grow a lot, though, and defy you. And it's gonna, I'm going to grow a big lump right in the middle of your liver. It's misery. It is. It's like misery become physical. And bliss melts it out, supposedly. That's the Buddha's medicine. So that's the Buddha. Point is, so medicine Buddha, therefore, since they have a theory like that, the medicine Buddha, vision of human life, not just human, animal life, animate life, and the potential of evolution toward enlightenment, that is this kind of inconceivable evolution. And it differs from mystics of almost all the religious tradition, at least how they are sort of understood by people, and particularly when they have a theory that sort of nirvana is, and even different types of Buddhists, actually, so-called Buddhists, who think that nirvana is somewhere else. So they think the highest thing is to leave, which of course is an expression of the ultimate alienation and isolation. This all sucks, and nobody's in bliss, everybody's in a horrible state, and we're going to go to some bliss state somewhere else. And then Buddha frustrates those people because he says to them, well, yeah, okay, you can escape from your suffering. But then they say, well, what will it be like when I've escaped? And he said, well, can't really say. We just call it nirvana. You'll be blown away. Well, but what will that be like? Will my self still be there? Oh, well, we can't really say. Can't say there's no self there. Can't say there's self there. Oh. So he frustrates them by not being able to explain that precisely because obviously if there was a state that was freedom and bliss, apart from life, it would be a relative state. It would not be the absolute state, and therefore ultimately reliable. It would not be ultimate reality. Ultimate reality means the actual reality, uncreated, primordial, always here, we're here right now. Or there's no such ultimate thing. It's just all this mess. So So that's just logical, you know, and simple inference. They can figure that out. After a while, when they get frustrated, he won't say. He even said to those same people in the, among the Buddhists who think that the highest thing is Nirvikalpa Samadhi, or, you know, just being off in space as an infinite God, or disappearing and not having to wash any dishes ever again, and whatever it is, that not be bothered by anybody because nobody's there, you know? You're not even there, but nobody else is, and it's just bliss is there. It's like someone in the 60s said, like, the universe is a giant jar of Vaseline. It shows what he thought was fun. Anyway, so that person. So my point is that this is nirvana, if there is such a thing. You know, it's right now, here and now. That's the main thing, and the medicine is involved in that. And Buddha's idea really is that. You know, the dualistic form of Buddhism cannot manage the debate. You know, cannot. And that's a shock to people. I'm afraid I know a couple of Buddhists who are completely crazed, and they're caught what is called in Zen in the demon ghost cave. And that means the demon ghost cave is where you are a spiritual practitioner and you have some remarkable experience, because there's lots of them to be had, but then you interpret that experience is that I'm enlightened because I had that experience. Well, I'm sort of back here and brought down and I have to hang out. But then when I die, I'll go back there because there's a there that's elsewhere. And then they start acting superior to other people and they become megalomaniacs and they become bad gurus. We've noticed quite a few. And not just in Buddhism, in all every tradition. And that comes from either feeling you are enlightened or you have someone, you're channeling someone who's enlightened. That's called the demon ghost cave. Zen is Chan and Zen are really great traditions. They really are, although easily misunderstood also. So, okay, back to medicine. Back to the tree. Come on, tree. So health in Buddhist medicine, here's health over here. This right here, this is health. This flower. Well, these are worldly health. The ultimate health is here, this second flower. And it's Buddhahood itself. So true health is only Buddhahood. And you know the so-called three humors that you will hear, read about if you read about Tibetan medicine, which shouldn't be called humors, that's from the Greek, where you had black bile, yellow bile, blood, and phlegm, were the four humors, I think. But that means, because humor means fluid. But qi, wind, energy, prana, is not fluid. It's pure energy, motion. It's electricity. It's like magnetism. It's all kind of invisible energy, massless energy. You know that energy has no mass. You know that. That's the difference between energy and matter. It has no mass. So, but that doesn't mean it's not powerful. Just like mind has no mass, but it's powerful, actually. That even the physical and materialist scientists have something that no mass but has power, which is, they pretend to be very difficult to conceive when somebody's insisting that they consider the mind to be part of nature. But actually energy they consider part of nature, and it also has no mass, so it's not material. Anyway, never mind. So these five petals, and they are like long life. These lower ones are worldly. They're wealth, happiness, long life, bliss, etc., etc. But above them are enlightenment. Because enlightenment, and then this is, shows you the power and the importance of Buddhist medicine in India. The three poisons in the spiritual teaching, right? Delusion, ignorance, misknowledge, whatever you want to call it, avidya. You know, not knowing, it's not just not knowing. It's knowing something that's wrong as if it was right. So that's why I say misknowledge or misperception or misunderstanding is better than ignorance. Because, although that's a form of it, but ignorance. And then lust or greed and hatred or anger. And those three, physically, are the three ills. They're actually called the three ills. The word ne, or dosha in Sanskrit, means a flaw. You know, which they, the three dosha, they call it in Sanskrit. And they go the three humors, because they want Westerners not to be frightened. But actually, they mean the three flaws. The three ills, the word ne means sickness itself. So the three sicknesses. So by themselves, they're sicknesses. In balance, they can lead toward Buddhahood and health. And actually, the bile becomes intelligence and ultimate reality, perfection, wisdom. The phlegm becomes mirror wisdom, and equality wisdom, earth and water, delusion becomes mirror wisdom. Ignorance, misknowledge becomes the mirror wisdom. And then there's equality wisdom and individuating wisdom, etc. I think that's the bile. Bile becomes that. Okay. Thank you. Nice to see you. You need to go. It's okay. Is it a time? No, still we're not time. Oh my God, it's almost 9 o'clock. How time is like weird. It goes so quickly. How did that happen? We're just getting started here. So that's the enlightenment up there, you see. And these are the seven physical constituents, you know, from the serum after eating, the digestive serum, blood and bile, and then muscle and fat, and then the excretions. You know, these are the seven, what are called the seven bodily constituents. And these are the three types of diagnosis, etc. So this one trunk is all the positive things. You know, the nature of life is all there. And then over here begins to have the different disorders, you know, and there's many more branches and things. And you sort of memorize that, and that's a really good thing. One time I was talking with, I was translating for that same doctor in a conference, and actually Fritjof Capra made a derogatory remark about the three element theory, or the, you know, Chinese has yin yang, two element, and Ayurveda and Tibetan medicine have the three element, but which fits with the Tibetan, I mean with the Buddhist, three addictions, you know, of delusion, hatred, and ignorance. Physically, they are these three substances in the body. So that shows the root of it, you know, where the root of the Buddhist medicine is. So he said, you only have these like three things, and like we have a table of, you know, 129 table of elements, you know, and like plutonium, we discover new ones all the time, you know, of all different kinds of things, plutonium, uranium, you know, oxygen, hydrogen, etc. We have lots of things. You guys only have this. So then the doctor said, he used to be belligerent when people would challenge him. He was a debater, all Tibetans are. So he would say, well, we can do that. We have five elements, but we can do, each element has five different varieties by combining the way it combines with the other elements, like earth, 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 water, earth, fire, earth, wind, earth, space, earth. So there's five earths. So we can multiply each five by five, that's 25. Then we can further multiply the 25 by another 5, we have 125. Then we can get to 625. You guys don't have 129, like, forget it. We have 600, he said. We can do that. But, he said, the problem with you guys, he then says, and he didn't know Capra wasn't a medical doctor. There were some medical doctors there. But he said, the problem with you guys, he said, is you've humpty-dumptied the human being. So I thought he was speaking Tibetan. I mean, he was. I was translating Tibetan. So I'm saying humpty-dumpty. That's the one word I didn't learn yet. Humpty dumpty, because humpty dumpty, what verb is that, you know? No, he says, humpty dumpty. I say, yes, humpty dumpty, I'm going like this. And then he says, no, I mean humpty dumpty. He's saying this in Tibetan. You know, then finally I figured out he was using the English word humpty dumpty. And what he meant was that they have this big analysis down to cells and this whole kind of thing, you know, cell types and different things, tissues. But meanwhile, they don't know whether to tell a person to eat spinach or broccoli. They don't know whether they should eat hot tea or cold sodas. They don't know. It's all completely off in the stratosphere, you know, their analysis. It's not like Dalai Lama wrongly, somebody told him, I've been trying to get him not to stop it, but he hasn't yet. He wrongly talks about Tibetan medicine as holistic. And I'm trying to say, no, don't say that. Then people think that all the Tibetans are hippies. You know, it is very analytic. Their botany is huge. All those Asian plants and the unique things at high altitude, the extraordinary botany and chemistry they have. Also different kinds of stone and mineral, also different animal parts. You know, they're, you know, because it was everything, you know. It's very elaborate. But, so it's very analytic, but it keeps the analytic within principles, like when you first go to medical school, you memorize some stuff, and then you have this these trees, and so everything you fit back onto the tree. So that's a framework of these three trees, you see, that under the shade of which you conduct your practice. And then that lets you keep a holistic view of all this amazing analysis. But you can fit the analysis in, and they're not against it. Those great Tibetan doctors, they all decided about different modern chemical medicines and things like that, but they don't approve entirely of making everything out of petroleum, that level, because they feel that, these kind of active ingredient isolation processes, they then put some molecules that are used to being embedded in certain forms that have elaborated themselves on the planet for thousands of years. And so when they're stripped out and put in an intensified form, sometimes it can be helpful, but sometimes it then sucks out of your system all kinds of other things, and that's the side effect thing. So it wants to go back to its habitual, family of things, and it will draw stuff out of your system, and then it'll create side effects. So therefore, they make herbal pills that have 35 different ingredients, all balancing different side effect things, that are very, very excellent. And if that sort of principle could be integrated into chemical and other things, it would be really great. And that's what will happen, actually, when modern medicine realizes the ignorance level about modernity and materialism and the dogma of materialism, and goes back and connects to these more subtle things, And that will happen, I'm sure. So that's sort of a little bit about medicine Buddha. But again, I'm glad I did a little bit about Buddha himself. This is another tree. This is about different kinds of pills and procedures. This is the second tree. There's the third tree. And these are different outcomes and things. And all the 18 different things are in here. And it's really cute. I think, do I have more of these medical? The first medical atlas in history, actually, according to some scholars, that I haven't really double-checked their research, but I believe them. The oldest medical atlas in history was made in Tibet in the 1680s, 1670s and 80s. Like for barefoot doctors, where it shows little pictures of people taking the pulse and doing things. And also, maybe I'll tell you one last anecdote about the pulse reading. Like, I consider myself very left brain and, brainwashed by good schools in America, meaning bad schools overall, and male-dominated, chauvinist, weird, mathematically-oriented, linear-thinking schools. And so I am definitely, I'm not psychic. I had a complete concept like that. So how am I going to learn this pulse? I had to memorize what's called the Pulse Sutra, which is part of the medical text that you have to memorize, which is a lot of similes, metaphors and similes about different things that the pulse feels like when it's under your, like a thread being, someone flicking a thread where a knot is rolling through a rope, or like a cuckoo in the spring is intoxicated because the female cuckoos are calling and he's like staggering and his song is strange. I mean, all kind of funny metaphors, similes. So I memorized that, right? And then the doctor made me sit in front of him in the clinic and take everybody's pulse, as talking to them in different languages. Some languages I didn't understand, Hindi I didn't, Tibetan I did, and English I did. And so because they think talking to the patient is very important. That's one of the major they say tongue is a major diagnostic tool, by talking and asking the patient what's the matter with you and what happened yesterday, and discovering about their circumstances of their existence. They don't pretend there's some magic bullet that you can just not talk to them and reduce them to a lump, a pile of chemicals that you're going to then analyze with some machines. That's ridiculous. You have to talk to them and see what's wrong with them. Anyway, but the pulse is very important. And so then I would do pulse after pulse. And also you get clues because you look at the face. There's all kind of prognostication like that. And sure enough, after a while, some metaphor would pop in mind. One of the similes about this heart pulse or the kidney pulse or something. And it would be going, there would be a bloop bloop thing that would feel like one of the metaphors. And then I would start to get more accurate. And he would correct me, and he would have a riot when I got way off. And he'd laugh and poke fun, and they loved to tease. But I actually became the equivalent of psychic by the memorization and then the practice, in the sense that the verses would pop up, and then that verse linked to a certain diagnosis of a certain organ or a vessel, the five solid organs and the six vessels in the body. And I was acting like a psychic when I was getting good enough at it after a year and a half of it, that I was really getting pretty good. I could tell from the pulse. And I kind of lost track of it now. Years, that was 50 years ago. But it is what an amazing educational thing, in a sense, of being able to train someone to do that through memorizing a text and then hands-on, you know. And then it isn't that there's not some mysterious thing that, like, there's a vein that comes straight from the heart to this corner of this finger. You could also do that on a fingertip or on an earlobe with a baby who might be able to flail their arms, you know, or on the foot even. You know, you can do it on another part of the body. But they consider the heart is making the big noise of the different organs. So if you're too near the heart, then it'll drown out the pulsation of blood going in and out of the liver, in and out of the kidneys, in and out of the lungs. Because they also expand and contract. You know, blood flows in and goes out. And how they expand and the quality of their expansion, and whether they're clogged or not clogged, and all kind of thing, you can detect. This one guy detected parasites that they couldn't detect with stool tests and everything, although they knew I had it, called strongyloides at Mass General Hospital. They never could exactly detect it. And of course, they gave me that horrible vacuum cleaner fluid or whatever it is, vacuum. But that didn't get rid of it. He got rid of it, and he gave me medicine, got rid of it in 3 weeks. And he detected it. And I had forgotten that I had it. I wasn't complaining of anything. It's a very weird, there's some you know, very invisible parasites that come and go, you know, they're and you get little, like, funny little dots on the wrist or around the waist in certain seasons. Yeah, strongyloides, it's called. It's anybody who's medical knows about it. And he said, and I said, well, how did you know that? He said, well, because the way that your upper intestine was expanding and contracting, there was something gripping parts of it. It wasn't flowing right. It had obstruction in there, and I realized it was parasites. Wow. I was breathtaking. Really, it's breathtaking. And that can be trained. It isn't like everybody has to be a psychic. Of course, some people are better naturally than others. The most important thing, I think, in approaching a patient who is dying is whatever you're saying or doing, which will depend upon the circumstance and the ideologies and everything about the patient and the family of the patient and the whole thing and how much pain they're in, et cetera, all that will all depend on the circumstance. But I think the most important thing is that you, the medicine Buddha healer, if you are, then you are sort of seeing the deathlessness in that patient, that the continuum of their life force will go on. And rather than worrying about losing it forever, they're just leaving a body that may not be functioning well anymore. And they're actually heading for the most efficient method of rejuvenation and the cheapest one that there is for them. It's not going to be cheap for their parents, but it's going to be cheap for them. And so if you, even without saying that, whether, you know, in case they like a big materialist and they want to be nothing after death, you know, they don't want to have a future life, or if they want to go to heaven, or whatever it is, you don't have to interfere with any of that. The fact that you feel that will communicate itself to them, because there'll be a feeling of calm, of like it'll be all right, whatever it is, will emanate, because you will not get caught up in that sort of thing, you know? Like the first thing, if you go to work in the morning or you go see somebody, and the first thing they do is they go, then you, oh, what's wrong with me, you know? If they smile and look happy with you, then you'll feel a little bit relaxed too. So that's really the keyest thing. So it's the doctor's own mind that realizes the power of life, which is what Buddha, you know, is what Buddha discovered. That's why he was smiling. That's why it has been such a huge tradition, in spite of the fact that it's anti-militarism, it's anti-selfishness, it's anti all the things that we are wrongly taught in our education are indispensable to every human society. You have to be nasty, you have to be out for yourself, you have to be violent, you have to be... They were all taught that. It's wrong. And Buddha's news was that it was wrong, and the fact that it's been such a huge tradition on the planet shows that the human beings as a whole know that. So, you know, we can... That's what I take comfort. I'm still taking comfort. I did so through the Bush administration, the Reagan, the Nixon, but I got better and better at it, and now I'm putting the ultimate challenge. And that is that the absolute stupidity and incompetence of the so-called rulers proves that we're almost free of them. And we are going to rise up and make things bright. We're not all that stupid. But the point is, the incredible stupidity of those people should give us hope.
Weekly interstitial music provided by Tenzing Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more about Tenzing Chogyal, please visit his website at tenzingchogyal.com. Study Buddhism up close and personal with Robert Thurman and friends during the 2018 Tibet House US membership trip to Bhutan with Geographic Expedition. To learn about this docet tour, please visit tibethouse.us. All proceeds from Geographic Expedition trips go to benefit the ongoing work of Tibet House US. Help the Bob Thurman podcast become self-supporting and contact us about potential sponsorship opportunities. We'd love to help you get word out about your brand, your teacher, your upcoming event, or your project. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz. We'd love your support and we'd love to help you get word out about your projects. I can be reached at justin@menla.org. And if you're inspired by what you hear here, please be sure to like, subscribe, and follow us on iTunes, Facebook, Twitter, and all your favorite social media platforms.